This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, October 1st, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court weighs whether corporations operating in the U.S. can be liable for human rights violations committed abroad. Labor advocates from the U.S. and Mexico press the Mexican government to protect guest workers at Walmart suppliers. In Russia, supporters of the band Pussy Riot rally in a case that has brought focus on restrictions on social expression in the country. And we'll hear from a journalist in Tehran who faces sentencing in court.
Our job is not to run away or to flee the pressure. Our job is to remain there, find a way to report correctly.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Another U.S. soldier died in Afghanistan over the weekend. The Associated Press says it's the 2,000th member of the U.S. military to die in the longest war in U.S. history. The attack happened at a checkpoint, but reports conflict about the details. The number of civilians killed in the 11-year war is not known, but most estimates say at least 20,000 have died. In October 2001, the U.S. led a coalition force to Afghanistan to oust the Taliban and rout al-Qaeda. The U.S. still has almost 70,000 service members in the country, along with their coalition colleagues and contractors. In Iraq, another series of bombs killed at least 26 people yesterday, bringing the total dead there in September to 365. The attacks struck Shiite targets, and according to Hakim al-Zamili, a Shia member of parliament, the situation in Iraq is still unstable and shows that security forces are still unqualified to deal with the terrorists. California Governor Jerry Brown was busy signing laws this weekend, including a measure that bans so-called treatment for gay kids that tries to make them straight. He also signed a bill that gives juvenile offenders sentenced to life without parole another chance at freedom, and he gave the okay to driver's licenses for undocumented youth. But he wielded the veto pen as well, and immigrant rights activists say two of their top priorities were blocked. KPFA's Christopher Martinez explains.
Immigrant rights activists collected petitions, held prayer vigils, and even sent flowers to California Governor Jerry Brown, urging him to sign a pair of measures to limit deportations and grant basic workers' rights to housekeepers and other domestic workers. But late Sunday, Brown vetoed both measures. The bills were a top priority for the California Immigrant Policy Center. Reshma Shamasunder, the center's director, says she sees the vetoes as Brown turning his back on immigrant communities.
This was Governor Brown's opportunity to be a champion, for California to be a leader. Instead, he's failed us. Instead, you know, thousands of families will continue to be separated, immigrants deported, and domestic workers won't have access to the types of labor protections that, you know, most other workers enjoyed.
The Domestic Workers Bill of Rights would have given California's 200,000 domestic workers, most of them immigrant women, the right to overtime pay and meal and rest breaks. It's similar to a measure recently enacted in New York State. The other bill, called the Trust Act, would have limited local police participation in the federal Secure Communities program that has led to the deportation of almost 80,000 undocumented Californians. Activists say they'll continue the struggle in the legislature and in the courts. Christopher Martinez, FSRN, Berkeley.
Security forces patrol a Bangladesh village today after weekend rioters burned down at least 13 Buddhist temples and monasteries, along with dozens of houses. The violence started after a picture of a burnt Quran appeared on Facebook. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari reports.
Police have arrested more than 150 people and are looking for 1,500 more in connection with the violence and arson. On Saturday, Muslims, already angry over an anti-Islam film made in the United States, attacked a Buddhist-majority village in Cox Bazar. They ransacked homes and torched Buddhist monasteries and temples. The violence later spread to the neighboring Chittagong district and continued through the night until security forces reached the area early Sunday. Buddhists staged a silent protest in the capital Dhaka on Sunday afternoon. A heavy contingent of security forces is now patrolling and public gatherings have been banned in the Buddhist-dominated areas. Senior officials say the man who posted the image that started the violence has been detained and is in protective custody. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari, FSRN.
Hundreds of protesters marched in Chicago yesterday, calling for more jobs for blacks. The rally was called by prominent black Chicago businessman, 87-year-old Ed Gardner, who stopped work at the same job site last week after he drove by and saw no black workers. A few marchers spoke to Chicago's CBS 2 News.
We're concerned about black people working, not necessarily minorities. Minorities got their jobs, the black people don't.
This may be groundbreaking because you have a retired senator, you have retired judges, you have the president of Chicago State University, you have black millionaires.
It's a shame that an 87-year-old man had to stop his car and come out here to protest us.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel says the city has strict hiring rules and they must be enforced. The company said there were no black union cement layers available for hire. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments today to answer a basic question: should corporations operating in the U.S. be liable for human rights violations committed overseas? The outcome of Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum could determine whether other corporations around the world can be held accountable under a 200-year-old law called the Alien Tort Statute. FSRN's Alice Olstein was in the courtroom this morning and files this report.
The namesake of the Supreme Court's first case this term is Esther Kiobel, the widow of a Nigerian activist targeted for demonstrating against Royal Dutch Petroleum, also known as Shell.
My husband, he was the breadwinner of the family, and since Shell and Abacha government killed him, oh my goodness, I've lost more than 5 members of my immediate family. Life's so horrible.
Kiobel's husband Barney Nem was executed by the Sani Abacha military dictatorship, along with Ken Sarawiwa and 7 others in 1995. The surviving Ogoni activists and their families have been trying for more than a decade to hold Shell accountable for aiding and abetting the Nigerian military's violent crackdown on residents who protested oil spills and environmental exploitation in the Niger Delta. Yet throughout Monday's arguments, lawyers for Shell and the Justice Department and several Supreme Court justices warned that allowing the lawsuit against Shell to go forward would put several U.S. corporations and individuals at risk.
What if people try to haul the president into a Dutch court for bombing of Libya?
That's Shell Oil attorney Kathleen Sullivan speaking outside the court after the hearing. She said a ruling against Shell would bring conflict with foreign governments because the U.S. would be guilty of projecting its domestic laws abroad.
This case has nothing to do with the United States. The events took place in Nigeria. The defendants are English and Dutch companies. The plaintiffs are all Nigerian citizens and were located in Nigeria at the time, so there's no conduct in this country.
During the arguments, several justices questioned why the plaintiffs didn't file the lawsuit in the Netherlands or the UK, where Shell Oil is based, or in Nigeria. The plaintiff's lawyer, Paul Hoffman, argued that the U.S. was their adopted home, and the crimes against them violate universally accepted norms the U.S. has the obligation to enforce. One of the plaintiffs, Tony Adigma, told FSRN the U.S. should also hear the case because it claims to support the right to protest.
I came into this country, I saw people who are demonstrating on the street of this country. There is nobody, no soldier, nobody arrested them. No army, no police arrested these people to torture them. But where I come from, you don't have the freedom to express yourself.
A member of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, Adigma was arrested and interrogated by the military regime after he organized several marches and protests against Shell in Nigeria.
If you look at my teeth, the down one is broken because of the torture I had. I still have scars in my back here, but that's not what I'm here for. It is wrong to torture your fellow human being.
The Supreme Court first heard the Kiobel case back in February. Arguments then focused mainly on whether corporations can be sued under the Alien Tort Statute or only individuals. The justices then argued the case to be re-argued, broadening the question to whether any case against a foreign entity for harming foreign individuals can be heard in a U.S. court. Rick Kurtz with Earth Rights International, who filed a brief supporting Kiobel, said the justices should preserve the Alien Tort Statute's international reach. He called it a vital tool for protecting environmental activists like the Ogoni plaintiffs.
I hope they understand that the arguments made by Shell just aren't persuasive, and that, of course, you know, if you commit a crime that's a violation everywhere in the world, you should be held liable where you can be found.
If the court sides with Shell, it could mean less accountability for multinational corporations, especially those in conflict zones and countries with autocratic regimes. Several companies who themselves have been accused of abuses abroad filed briefs supporting Shell, including Coca-Cola, KBR, Chevron, and BP. But if the justices agree that the plaintiffs have jurisdiction, they would then have to wrestle with the question of corporate liability. The court could also follow the advice of the Solicitor General, who argue that cases against foreign individuals and corporations can be brought on a case-by-case basis. Donald Verrilli said the court should dismiss the Kiobel case, but consult with the State Department in future cases to make sure they properly balance international human rights concerns with U.S. foreign policy interests. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
The results of Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum could have major implications for other multinational corporations accused of complicity in human rights violations and for the victims who have been seeking justice. One of those cases centers on ExxonMobil, the world's largest private oil company, and accounts of a handful of villagers in the Indonesian province of Aceh. Emily Johnson has more from the rice fields of Aceh.
The fence that surrounds the ExxonMobil facility in Aceh is about 10 feet tall and topped with barbed wire. On one side is a vast industrial complex. On the other is a tranquil expanse of rice fields, a common sight here among the agrarian villages outside of Lhokseumawe, Aceh's second largest city. A water pipeline runs the length of the fence. Teenagers are using it as a bench as they watch a pickup soccer game on a makeshift field across from an empty airstrip. There's a dirt road that connects the four main clusters of buildings and liquefied natural gas fields that make up ExxonMobil's Arun operation. The road is busy, but these days it's humming with local people on motorcycles rather than the military vehicles of years past. Up until 2005, a separatist conflict ravaged this region for decades. Now, the road's poor condition makes for a bumpy ride. I'm driving past the gas fields with Ibrahim, a local man who volunteers as a coordinator for a victims group. He points out various landmarks. The military post, where he says his friend was tortured. The warehouse, where he says human bones were found.
In the time, there is a children's playing around and digging something. Maybe they want to find something, and then they found a skeleton.
Ibrahim says scenes like this were commonplace during the conflict in Aceh, which came to a climax between 1999 and 2005. In these years, the Indonesian military waged a brutal campaign against the separatist Free Aceh movement, known as GAM. Aceh's civilians suffered the worst. Houses were burned, women were raped, and young men were tortured or executed for real or imagined connections to GAM. During the same period, Mobil Oil, which merged with Exxon in 1999, was extracting natural gas from the Arun field. The company had been working in the area since the 70s. Not far from the gas fields, we meet a man sitting on a bamboo porch outside an old home. He rolls up his pant leg to show a nasty scar.
So it was come from here, and then the bullet is passed through this way.
This man is known as John Doe 8 in a civil action he and three other alleged victims filed against ExxonMobil in 2007. The complaint describes an unprovoked attack that left him unable to work. It says a group of Indonesian soldiers working as security for ExxonMobil shot him in the knee and left him in a ditch. He says the trauma of that day still haunts him.
Sometimes it's just flash in my memory. Can I survive? Can I survive? Because every day during the time, many soldiers come, and then there's a flash in his head. Is there going to shoot me anymore? Memories keep coming.
He pulls on a clove cigarette as he tells his story, just one of many similar accounts shared in villages throughout Aceh. He says the years around his 2004 attack were a dangerous time for any young man in the village. He wears false teeth, a souvenir of another run-in with soldiers he says were working for ExxonMobil.
If we say hi, they will say, "What are you looking for? What are you asking me?" And then they get angry, and sometimes they slap people and then kick people. And then when we keep silent, they will say, "You're very proud of yourself, don't you?" And then kick them.
He's not the only John Doe to seek justice in a case against ExxonMobil. In 2001, 11 other plaintiffs filed a related suit. Both cases say ExxonMobil is responsible for the alleged actions of its agents. ExxonMobil spokesperson Doug Eglinton recently told the Dallas Morning News that all the claims were baseless and that ExxonMobil condemns human rights violations in any form. Eglinton added that the company has a long history of improving the quality of life for the people of Aceh with added jobs, health services, and other community investments. Eglinton would not comment on the specifics of the case. But last year, a federal appeals court ordered Exxon to stand trial on whether the company should have known about potential abuses and taken more precautions against them. The U.S. Supreme Court is addressing this issue of accountability in Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Shell. The Nigerian plaintiffs say the Alien Tort Claims Act gives them the right to sue entities like Shell for aiding and abetting atrocities like torture and murder. Shell says the act doesn't apply, that only individuals and not corporations can be held liable for human rights violations. Human rights lawyer Terry Collingsworth is following this case closely.
I think that it would be a very, very large public disaster for the Supreme Court to, on the one hand, say corporations have all the rights and all the benefits of a citizen of the United States, but only corporations get this special immunity from human rights violations.
It's Collingsworth who co-represents John Doe 8 in the 2007 case, a simple tort suit. And it was his firm that also sued ExxonMobil in federal court on the other suit, which used the Alien Tort Statute on behalf of 11 Achenese villagers and their families. That's the case waiting on the Supreme Court. A ruling in favor of the Kiobel plaintiffs could clear the way for ExxonMobil to stand trial as early as next year. A ruling for Shell would likely mean none of the plaintiffs will have the chance to see their cases through. Emily Johnson, FSRN, Aceh, Indonesia.
This report was produced with the support of the media NGO Project Word, with reporting and production assistance from Mia Lobel, Hannah Rapley, Lisa Riordan-Seville, and Laird Townsend. For additional reporting on this story, visit www.projectword.org/Aceh, and that's spelled A-C-E-H. Workers' rights advocates and labor leaders from the U.S. are in Mexico to call on the government to step up efforts to prevent forced labor in Walmart's U.S. supply chain. In June, Mexican guest workers exposed poor conditions at a Walmart seafood supplier in Louisiana. Workers said they were forced to work 24-hour shifts and were threatened with beatings. In response, Walmart suspended ties to the supplier pending an internal investigation. But the National Guest Worker Alliance says it has preliminary evidence of labor violations at 12 other Walmart suppliers that rely heavily on guest workers, many of whom are from Mexico. The facilities are located in states across the U.S., including Mississippi, Georgia, Virginia, Texas, and California. For more, we're joined by Valeria Scorza, Deputy Director of the Project of Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, a civil society organization in Mexico. She joins us from Mexico City. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
So who have you met with so far?
So today we had a meeting with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs here in Mexico City and requesting several points to the Mexican government. The first request was that the Mexican government reveal all its suppliers in North America that hire workers from Mexico. The second was requesting the U.S. Department of Labor do a special investigation into labor conditions for Mexican nationals on Walmart USA supply chain. We also requested the Mexican government to request the Department of State to perform an inquiry into the health and safety of Mexican nationals of the Walmart USA supply. And lastly, we requested that the foreign ministry could also have a close collaboration with the Mexican Ministry of Labor and the Mexican State Department in order to really pursue an investigation and coordination of what are the conditions of workers leaving Mexico and going to work abroad under the guest worker programs.
We're talking about Walmart, a company that is global but based in the U.S., and the suppliers, such as the CJ Food supplier in Louisiana that started this latest investigation. Explain why the focus on Mexico and why the Mexican government for these facilities that are in the U.S.?
Well, because in this supply chain, what we have found in the NGA, the National Guest Worker Alliance had found in their reports is that most of the guest workers are Mexicans. So most of their labor force is coming from Mexico. So we are requesting the Mexican government to have a protection to their co-nationals and to have they have the obligation to protect Mexicans abroad. So that's why we're requesting all these issues.
And those are Mexican citizens, not Mexican Americans.
No, they're Mexican citizens.
And also one of those who joined this coalition is the National Organization for Women. Talk about the number of workers who are women and the obstacles that women face in this.
Most of the guest workers are women, and specifically they affect women issues regarding discrimination, for example, and other issues. So we see that the Walmart model has They affect specifically to women the type of modeling of business that they do. So for us, it was really important also to highlight what is the effects of this type of forced labor towards women.
Valeria Scorza is the deputy director of the Project of Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. She joined us from Mexico City. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Free speech radio news is a choice that matters. Respected worldwide for our coverage of social justice issues are investigations into how government and corporate policies affect people and our monitoring of environmental threats, struggles for equality, and much more. You choose to listen to FSRN to hear stories and voices ignored and unheard in the corporate and government press. Find out how you can help support us at our website, fsrn.org, where you can also download our newscasts, documentaries, and special reports. FSRN, a choice that matters. The bureau chief in Tehran for the news agency Reuters is facing a court sentence this week over so-called propaganda-related offenses for a headline posted earlier this year. According to the AP, Parisa Hafezi, who is an Iranian citizen, was convicted Sunday by a special media court in Iran. At issue is a headline for a video Reuters posted in February that initially described a group of women in martial arts training as, quote, assassins. After the story, the Iranian government suspended the Reuters bureau in Tehran, and most of the staff left the country, but Hafezi was not allowed to leave, according to the AP. In October 2011, FSRN sat down with Hafezi in Los Angeles when she was visiting to receive a Courage in Journalism Award from the International Women's Media Foundation. She began by answering why she stayed in Iran following the 2009 protests, even after she and her staff came under increasing pressure.
Because this is my job. Our job is not to run away or to flee the pressure. Our job is to remain there, find a way to report correctly. That's what I believe and I have always believed in. So that's why I chose to stay. And I prefer to be there and to experience that pressure but to report correctly.
In early 2010, during a time when reform leaders called for anti-government protests to restart, Hafezi was abducted, detained, and faced interrogation. She described what she sees as the role of an independent media in Iran.
Our job is to report impartially. Our job is to understand the facts and reflect it and convey that message to the world without being afraid of pressures that we get. This is our job, and we are doing that. Me and many of my colleagues in Iran who chose to stay in Iran.
That's Parisa Hafesi, Reuters bureau chief for Tehran, speaking to FSRN October 2011. On Sunday, Hafesi was convicted in a media court in Iran. The Committee to Protect Journalists lists Iran as one of the top censored countries for media in the world. As of December 2011, 42 journalists were held in custody, the highest documented by the organization in the world. In Russia, a scheduled appeal hearing for three members of the feminist punk band Pussy Riot was postponed today after one of the defendants refused the representation of her lawyers. The move was unexpected, and the reasons for the refusal are unclear. Out in the streets, supporters gathered for a global day of action in support of the band members, who were sentenced in August to 2 years in jail. The Pussy Riot case is leading to legal efforts to further restrict social freedoms in Russia in an effort some call dangerous. FSRN's Ekaterina Danilova reports.
Dozens of activists gathered in St. Petersburg to call for the release of the three band members from jail. They also called for all political prisoners to be let free and for an end to legal measures restricting social freedoms. Pavel is a member of the anarcho-communist group Autonomous Movement.
We came here today to say no to all this tyranny of the police that is happening in our country, to say no to all these false charges, huge amounts of which are brought in our country, all the false evidence of policemen and judges who are bribed.
Pussy Riot's imprisonment for performing an anti-Putin song in a Moscow cathedral in February has spurred sympathetic political actions against the Orthodox Church. For example, a feminist group cut down a cross outside a church in Kyiv. This in turn has sparked legislation criminalizing criticism of the church, which was just introduced in the parliament. If passed, the law would create a penalty of up to 3 years in prison for insulting believers' feelings. Olga Kurnosova is an opposition leader who opposes the measure.
It's absolutely clear that the law appeared mainly in connection with Pussy Riot, but it confirms one more time that they are in jail because of an unjust sentence.
Vyacheslav Plakhatnyuk is a political lawyer. He says that such a law would be harmful and could start a process of religious radicalization.
I think that this type of legislative development is harmful because we will orient our society to search for manifestations of anti-religious behavior. On the whole, I think this additional restriction of human rights is absolutely unnecessary.
The legislation criminalizing criticism of religious persons will be discussed in Parliament this fall. The Pussy Riot appeal hearing is set to continue next week. Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, Russia.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news story specials and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.